It's been a while since I published a podcast. I've been busy. And as some of you know, I've been creating a community for cellists online. But I've also been performing, playing a lot of chamber music, solo recitals, and the usual fare of orchestral playing. But today, I have an interview conducted by one of my cello students for his live music class at the University of Pittsburgh. He invited me to be the subject because the class attended Madame Butterfly the week before, where I was a member of the orchestra. Welcome back to A Cello Rondo. I'm Paula Tuttle, and today I'm with Ming Xuan as we discuss live music.
Hello, Ms. Tuttle. My name is Ming. I'm Ming Xuan. I'm currently enrolled in the Music Culture and History program. I've learned from your personal website that you play in chamber ensembles and you participate in an orchestra, luckily with Pittsburgh Opera. My first question to start it off is, how does your role compare, how does your experience of performing in an orchestra compare to playing in a chamber ensembles? How does each differ from performing as a soloist, if at all?
Right. Well, it's really a matter of degree, the amount of agency that you have as a musician. So in any ensemble, we share that agency. And the main difference is there's a conductor in front of an orchestra, right? So when you're a soloist in front of an orchestra, you have some artistic say in that performance. So what it really comes down to is that, exactly. When do you get to contribute to the artistic decisions in a performance? So you get to make decisions about tempo, phrasing, and dynamics, and the composer gets to set most of that. But as a player in an orchestra, you interpret the music too, but the conductor sets the tempo, and they get to make most of the musical choices. So in my experience, musicians in orchestras like to be given some of the responsibility. Some conductors don't like to share. They dictate everything right down to the length of a dotted 16th note, and others give you license. They let you shape a phrase, and maybe as the week or the production develops, they start to adopt some of your ideas. And sometimes it's a two-way street, and musicians prefer that as a rule. So let's say you're in a chamber ensemble, and you surely have control of the tempo. You are also in charge of keeping the tempo, so you need to move a lot more. And if you're in a string quartet or a trio of some kind, we need to look at each other and listen in a way that's different than in an orchestra. It's hard to explain because you actually learn how to play in a chamber ensemble from playing in orchestra. You learn to make chamber music with the people around you. That's the way I like to think about it in an orchestra, because we're so fixated on our section and the conductor, but we actually need to listen to everybody around you. So all the music is essentially the same. It's just how much control do we have?
And speaking of conductors, I also wonder if there are some shared qualities the conductor you've been working with, you enjoy working with, tend to share.
So more than anything, I want the concert to be a success. And seeing how conductors achieve that is very interesting, because the conductor is in charge of the rehearsal, right? And no matter how good his ideas or his stick technique are, if he can't rehearse efficiently, the opera or ballet will not be a success. So number one, a conductor has to get the orchestra ready. And I've been in concerts where the orchestra wasn't ready. And I remember doing a New Year's Eve concert where you're doing a lot of Strauss waltzes and things. And they're really hard because there's a road map. Have you ever done one of those? Yeah. You know, you have DC Alphinade going to the sign and then going to the coda. And maybe there's a repeat within it. And they say, take the repeat within the DC Alphinade. It can be very complicated, and an entire orchestra can get lost. And I remember a couple of crash and burns in my stand partner. He nailed it. He said, the conductor did not prepare us properly. Hmm. Okay? So things cannot go well. Who cares what the interpretation is if the orchestra gets lost, right? So that's a simple explanation. So let's assume that we're talking about performances that are well prepared by the conductor, and now he gets to display some of his other qualities. Well, I prefer it when the conductor doesn't approach things with too much control, like I said before. And it's a tough needle to thread. When they let go, and to what degree, if there's a feeling of trust, the orchestra feels it, and things get better. They are always better that way. When the conductor is essentially saying, I did my job, now you do yours, we've got this. Some productions rely heavily on stick technique and to get us through, others would do better to loosen the reins just a bit.
Interesting. So just a quick follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Do you think the stick technique of the conductor or the beforehand preparation is more important for the overall quality of the performance?
That's hard to say. It depends on the piece and how difficult the piece is. Both are equal, but they're not equal. You have to have good stick technique and you have to prepare the orchestra.
Okay.
So most of the time, the conductors I work with have good stick technique.
Okay.
Not all of them can rehearse at the same efficiency, but most of them do, especially in opera and ballet, because they're so long and so complicated.
Yeah.
No.
So when we talk about a conductor's interpretation of a piece, so does it, like, in actuality, does it actually lean more on the stick technique or like the preparation in rehearsals?
The stick technique.
Okay.
Yeah. He has to convey his ideas and he talks about them. He has to be able to tell people what his idea is. And we can hopefully do it, but the stick technique is what really tells us what he wants. Yeah.
Okay. I want to move on to the question of whether there are, for you, any differences or similarities between playing rehearsals and performing on stage.
Okay, that's an interesting question, because whether it's a string quartet, a professional orchestra, a community orchestra, or a high school band, something changes when we're in a performance. Or when we're on stage. So I'm not talking about on stage for a rehearsal. When we're on stage performing, something happens. There's a collective focus and we play better. We have a shared goal and things happen that can't happen in just a rehearsal. That's what's really great about it. And maybe that's why people gravitate to music. They enjoy the experience of playing together, and public performances are a unique experience. They really are. I did a brief stint with a high school band where I got to rehearse them and then play a concert where all their parents were there, right? So I got to conduct a rehearsal and then in a performance. And the attention in the rehearsal was pretty scattered, but then in the performance, the kids were just glued to me. And it was a revelation, you know? And after that, I thought a bit about becoming a conductor because it was a great experience. But eventually, I decided I liked playing an instrument more than conducting.
Well, that's understandable, totally understandable to me.
Yeah, to a person that plays the cello.
Yeah, I probably would have made the same choice. My next question is, how do you typically prepare for a performance? Like, are there any routines or habits you find especially helpful right before going on stage? I remember you sharing some of your techniques with me. So I just want to hear a more articulate answer on that one.
Right, so we can memorialize some of the things I often talk about.
Yeah.
So depending on the performance, I might do a few things. So let's say it's a big solo performance of some kind, and I've developed some basic warm-ups that I like to do. I think I told you about that.
Right.
On the day of the performance, I'll focus on warming up more than playing my piece, you know. I'll play open strings and that sort of thing. And during the day, I hope to get some rest, and I would avoid playing through the recital or concerto on that day. Hmm. I might play phrases or the beginnings, but you don't want to leave it in the locker room, as they say. You can detract from your focus if you play through everything on the day of your concert. Hmm. That's a hard lesson to learn for a lot of young musicians, because we have so much energy built up and we want to play. Yeah, it's very hard to not do that.
Yeah.
But the day before is a different matter. You can generally play all day, and you should, because you want to get in as good shape as you can before, and then save your strength on performance day. As far as what I do backstage or right before a big orchestral solo or something, again, hopefully you have a few moments to relax and get some focus, hopefully. I took a public speaking course once with a local actress, and her name was Donna Perkins, and she taught us how to get ready when you're in the wings before going out on stage. And I actually still do her exercises when I'm about to go on stage. And it helped me on several occasions. The exercises focus on breathing, visualization, and putting your mind in a place where you can perform.
Yeah. This is also very helpful for me if I'm ever going to perform publicly one day. And you said it's part of the focus is also to set yourself in the right mind before going on stage. Perhaps the 6 or 5 hours immediately before the performance, the focus would be very different, as you said, from the day before. Yeah.
Yeah, I think your focus heightens when you get on stage.
Yeah.
And maybe the 5 or 6 hours before, you're experiencing some nerves. I don't even like to say that word, nerves. A friend of mine said we never say that word in the green room. We say, I can't wait to get started.
Okay.
You know, I was kind of admonished, you know, saying that word. We don't say nerves. No, you are a bit nervous, and so you want to play. You can't wait to get started, and you tell yourself that. Rather than saying you're nervous. That's one good thing.
Okay.
I think everybody is going to learn over the course of your life what works for you.
Okay.
So not everybody's going to be the same.
Okay. We never say the word nerve. We only say we can't wait for the performance. This will make a very fine title for the podcast, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
We also, as a class, attended Pittsburgh Opera's recent production of Madama Butterfly. Many of us have expressed a deep appreciation of the quality of the production. And I want to hear, because I know that you participated in it as a member of the opera orchestra, so I would like to hear about your comment on it as an insider, and were there any insiders' perspectives that you think the audience would find interesting?
What goes on in those first rehearsals, a lot of people would be surprised. We have a conductor, Anthony Walker, who can sing really well. So I never had this with any other opera conductor. When we first read it, he just sings the opera while we play. And a lot of people were really surprised to hear that. Maybe I'll tell you a story about that at the end. I think the behind-the-scenes kinds of stories are always the most interesting. And the opera has more going on than any other medium. And on my podcast, I interviewed Mark Trofka, the chorus master of the Pittsburgh Opera, and his stories are just wonderful. The episode was about Il Trovatore, and he prepared for that opera for almost a year. It was amazing. And so Madame Butterfly has a chorus too, and the chorus, they have to handle a lot of stage issues, like being able to sing with the orchestra, follow the conductor, but still follow all the stage directions. They might have to walk, they might have to be doing something, pretending they're miming, pretending they're talking to each other. So it's always interesting to think about what a chorus has to do. They don't have any music, they have to have it memorized, right? But they have to sing together, right? So this production also had some really unique sets and stagings. So I'm sure there were a lot of headaches to deal with making it work. It's really hard for the chorus master. Me, I just sit in the pit. I don't have to move around. I get to read off the music. We've done Madame Butterfly many times, almost always the same music. This particular production had some musical inserts that we never played before. Hmm. So it's another version. Anthony Walker said that he did it like 15 years ago, so it's an established version. It's not that interesting. It wasn't that different from the other. So, yeah, we know Madame Butterfly pretty well.
Okay.
Yeah.
The more common version is the Paris version, while the version that we heard that day was actually another Italian version, I guess. Also heard that this piece is one of your favorites. Is that true?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Madame Butterfly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Madame Butterfly is great. I just love it.
I know you as a very versatile performer, deeply involved in the music scene of the Pittsburgh area, and you perform for live performances and also for recording and broadcasting. I'm just wondering, how does performing live compare to playing for recording or for broadcasting? Are they fundamentally different or actually not that quite so?
They're really different in a lot of ways. If you're talking about the PBS shows that I do, that takes hours and hours of recording. You know, sometimes we're there till 2 in the morning, and we might start at 8 in the morning, you know, with hardly any breaks. Hmm. That's just crazy. That's a crazy world altogether. And then they put it all together, and it looks beautiful. And sometimes we go into the recording studio to make the audio on top of the visual, you know. Sometimes we do all this. It's a wild ride. But it's always great fun. It really is. We love it. As far as performing live, like with an orchestra, what you see is what you get. You just get one shot. You know, there's no do-overs or anything like that. But like I said, there's something about the live performance that you get energy, you know, from having an audience. So let's talk about something in the middle. Like when we had to do a lot of live streaming during the pandemic, I have my own nonprofit, and I got a recording studio, and we did some live streams from there. Live streams are really hard. Hmm. You just, all of the technical stuff that you're trying to balance, you're hoping, praying that it's going out. There's no audience to give you any feedback. You're trying to act like it's a performance, but it doesn't feel like it. It feels very, very strange. So I'm glad that those days are gone. If I never live stream again, that's fine. I really don't like it.
It's rather surprising for me to hear that you said it's even more stressful for you to perform for broadcasting, performing live for broadcasting than actually performing on stage, because I believe many along with me would have thought it is more stressful to actually perform on stage because of all the audience. In another interview that our group have done, the interviewee says she actually obtains a kind of energy from the connection she feels from the audience. And I wonder, you have any similar feelings that can relate to that sentiment?
I think that that's common. I do. I definitely do. I feel a connection to the audience. And hopefully it's a good one, you know? Like if things are going well, you get some feeling from the audience.
Hmm.
You know, sometimes we'll do an opera many times, and the audiences are different every night. It's not just insert audience. I remember one production in particular where the audience was very animated on the Tuesday night performance, more so than any other. Mm. And you wonder why, you know?
Yeah.
Why was this audience so excited? Whereas the other performances were the same, nearly.
Wow.
You know? So it does make a difference.
So I guess that also had a different impact on you, these different groups of audience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You say, whoa, what are they hearing? Because a lot of times we can't see what's happening on stage. And that's the other thing, is there's a lot of really great stuff going on stage that matches the music and is mirroring the music, and I really can't look at it.
Hmm. That's very interesting to hear. I'm also curious about whether your experience as a performer has in any way influenced the way you experience live performances as an audience member. And for you, when you attend concerts, performances, what really counts as a good concert to you? What are the criteria?
Well, one aspect of it is a lot of times I know the piece before I go. And I think that that always enhances your experience because you have more, there's more depth to your perception and to your experience. But the truth is, because I am a musician, a lot of times I don't stay for entire concerts. You know, sometimes I feel like I had my fill. It's like going to a restaurant and you had a great course and you like the taste in your mouth and you're not ready to move on. So a lot of times I'll go to the symphony, and of course they're playing extremely well, but if there's a concerto soloist that just delights me, I don't want to stay any longer. I want that to linger. It stays in my mind, I play it through. You know, the music stays with me for a long time, so I'm not ready for more. So that's one thing that's different. One of the other things about going to concerts is I think I enjoy watching the stagecraft. You know, you as a regular audience member or regular audience members might appreciate it, but I want to see how they do it because I might need to know it from my perspective when I go on stage. How do they enter and exit? How do they greet the audience? How do they bow? How does the page turner turn the pages? How do they leave? And there's a lot of things I try to tell my students, you know, cellists, don't lean down and pick up your rock stuff before you walk off stage. It ruins your exit, right? So there's a lot of things to look at, and I enjoy that part of it.
Well, that's very interesting, Victor. I also remember that you went to a Shostakovich cello concert, and you told me that you left the concert right after the cello concerto. So perhaps you are thinking about preserving your feeling at the moment. You're preserving the impression that you were left.
That's exactly what it was. I didn't leave right away. I stick around and I talked to people. A lot of my students were there, and I actually saw them. And we, you know, compared notes and what was it like sitting here and there. And surprisingly, I was sitting in a very good seat for the concerto. Yeah, I knew I wasn't going to stay because it was a piece like Don Juan, something that I have suffered practicing for many, many hours, and I wanted to just leave the taste of the Shostakovich in my mind before I left the hall. And I'm glad I did.
Okay.
You know, I'm not sorry.
It's very interesting for me to learn that sometimes you get a better experience by, like, not staying for the whole thing, I guess. This is very novel to me. Perhaps I'll try doing so at some point.
It could be worth hearing both. You almost wish the intermission was longer.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely see what you're trying to say. I guess my last question on the list is a memorable concert or performance that you experienced. And if there is any, I wonder what made it stand out to you.
So you told me about this ahead of time, and I decided I would tell this story because I've always been wanting to tell this story.
Nice.
On my own podcast. Pittsburgh Opera, I know it was April 1st and April Fool's Day, and it was like 2008, and Christopher Hahn came out in the curtain saying, I promise you what I'm going to tell you is not an April Fool's joke. So we'd had a run of Aida, and people were getting sick. And it was the female role, and they rushed in Marianne Cornetti to fill in on like a Tuesday night, and she had to do Friday, but she couldn't stay for Sunday. But the original singer was better, but the tenor was getting sick, and we get emails, we don't know what's going to go on. So Christopher Hahn comes out and says, our tenor is going to try to make it through. We're not sure, he's not feeling well. So we're doing Aida, I think it's three acts. Tenor just kind of got through the middle of the second act, I think it was, and Anthony Walker had to finish the show.
Really? So the conductor of the orchestra then?
So he's conducting and singing at the same time.
I wish I was there. That must have been quite a scene.
It made news. It went news everywhere in the opera world that the conductor sang the rest of Aida. It was a tenor role, and he is a tenor. Now, Anthony can sing in almost any range. He'll sing the coloratura's soprano stuff in rehearsal way up there, and he'll sing the baritone stuff, but I think he is a tenor. And I think it's actually on the Wikipedia page of the Pittsburgh Opera that this happened. And Anthony said in an interview, he consciously had to keep his arms down low so that he could keep his support. And he sang from the pit, and he finished it. When he went up on stage, I don't know if he got the bow as the tenor. The other tenor stayed up there, and, you know, they say he just played the part, yeah, while someone off stage, in this case the conductor, sang. So that's happened before, where a singer is sick, they don't have time to teach someone the staging, they have someone off stage singing the part or in the pit. We've done that a few times. But this time the conductor actually sang Aida. So that was memorable. Yeah.
That was definitely memorable. If I were there, that would probably be the most memorable. So are there any other topics that you would like to touch upon? So some other things that my questions haven't touched upon that you would like to top it off with?
So we were talking about how different audiences will come in, yeah, and have different reactions.
Yeah.
In some organizations, you almost expect a dead audience on a certain night. Huh. Strange. I don't know why. Opening night is usually the most charged, you know? But that wasn't the case in the one I told you. It seemed like they just, on one night, they just loved it. So I try to pay attention. Which night are the most excited people there?
Okay.
You know, that's one thing. Different cultures. I think in some countries, they clap between pieces more, like between movements, like it's okay to do it. And in others, you're not supposed to do it. I personally think, what's the problem? If you like it, clap.
I noticed that in many American orchestras, including PSO, that the audience would show appreciation by clapping and standing up. And I just learned recently, actually I just learned last year, that it is not permitted in China, where I come from. I attended a New Year concert by London Philharmonic Orchestra, playing something by Richard Strauss and the Sixth Symphony of Tchaikovsky. Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly a typical New Year repertoire. And also Julia Hagen playing Haydn's Concerto Number 1. So that was also very meaningful to me. I stood up to clap, like what I do for all of my PSO concerts, but then the worker there, the staff member there, told me to sit down because it was not permitted. So I was very confused that in different cultures, like the convention of a concert attending could be like so different.
I wonder if it's political, because I know in Japan, they're crazy for standing up. You know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I toured in Japan once many years ago, and they always gave us standing ovations.
Okay.
Yeah, on almost every piece.
Huh.
It's audience participation, you know, it's the audience getting a chance to express themselves.
Yeah.
You know, saying, is it polite clapping? Or are they asking for another curtain call from the soloist?
Yeah.
And that's a big thing.
Okay.
You say Pavarotti got 9 curtain calls, you know, they count them, you know.
Yeah, well, that could definitely happen.
Yeah.
Mr. Tuttle, to be honest, I don't have any more questions. I think what you've just shared with me will be very valuable to me personally and also to our class members. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Ming Xuan is an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh. He graduates in 2026 with majors in both philosophy and musicology.
Thanks to Ming, I got the opportunity to sit on the other side of the interview table. Please share this episode with your friends or anyone you think would enjoy it. You can listen to all 112 episodes on our website, accelerandocast.com. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can send them to our email address, accelerandocast@gmail.com. Visit the show notes for even more information about each episode. That's all for now. Remember to support your community by attending live music events. We'll see you next time. Bye now.